We were in Venice during the Dark Ages on our last show. The show revolved around the gold-silver ratio and how silver had kept flowing from the west to the east, and much of it through Venice. You may recall this outflow of silver helped continue the Great Depression of Europe, called the Dark Ages. In 1327, the bankers of Venice were aware of the upcoming resumption of trade with India through Egypt, and expected to receive a large amount of gold from that trade. So, in 1327, they forced through a law fixing the ratio at 14.2 silver ounces to 1 ounce of gold. With this ratio, they expected to pay off their silver depositors with cheap silver. It didn't work. Silver just went out of circulation in a massive outflow to Constantinople. Trade with India didn't resume until 1343, and the inflow of gold forced the ratio of silver to gold down to 9 ounces of silver to 1 ounce of gold. From this point, gold began to appear in substantial quantities in Northern Europe. Europe continued to export about 20,000 tons of silver per year, and by the late 1300s, the silver famine had reached a crisis proportion, worse than anything that had taken place since the 7th century. In 1122, Don Michieli ran out of money to pay his soldiers, so he gave them stamped leather money. This temporary leather money was not legal tender, and was not institutionalized. Its general circulation was never intended to last, and it was redeemed very quickly. During the middle of the 15th century, coining machines came into Venice. Before the coining machines, a workman could manufacture 40 to 50 coins a day. With the coining machines, he could manufacture thousands. Banking had been banned by the Basileus, but with the fall of Byzantium, banking arose in Catalonian Spain and Genoa around 1200 AD. Due to the participation of the first three Crusades, the government had drained its treasury. When things turned desperate, the Doge borrowed money from his rich merchants and later paid it back. Then later, around 1173, the treasury was empty again, and Doge Zianini instituted a forced loan of 1% on the total property of each household. These loans were called imprestiti and paid interest at 4%. They were recorded and transferable at the imprestiti office, but no certificates were issued on these bonds. Since these imprestiti were transferable on the books, they became a means of payment between merchants and therefore were a very limited form of money, even though they were never intended as such and had no legal tender status. This is one of the first instances in the West where government debt was monetized, although not intentionally. There had been private banks in Venice from the 13th century, and all except the very small ones had gone bankrupt. One reason was because of Venice's own trading with the East that had dwindled the silver supply. Another reason was the requirement for the espiriti. Wealthy Venetians had to withdraw large sums from the bank. Venice chose not to have any banks until 1587, when the Camera del Imprestiti was turned into a deposit bank. It was among the earliest state deposit banks in Europe and was followed by the Bank of Amsterdam in 1609. As a deposit bank, a customer could transfer deposits from their account to other accounts in the same bank. Deposit banks were not supposed to make loans and were considered very secure, but Venice's deposit bank was bankrupt by 1600. This reflected the turmoil Venice was in from the early 1500s. By the early 1500s, Venice was declining in power because Portugal had discovered the Cape Route to India, and this ended Venice's domination of the East-West ratio mechanism. Also, at this time, the New World had been discovered by Columbus, and this brought large amounts of gold and silver to Europe. Adam Smith said that the twin discoveries of America and the Cape Route were the two most important events in economic history. At the time of the European discovery of America, only four Indian nations, all in Central and South America, used money. They used chiseled copper and cocoa beans. Montezuma's gold treasure was kept mainly in the form of exquisite artwork, not coins or bullion. When the Spanish came to America and encountered some natives with a few gold ornaments about them, and when they saw this gold, they immediately enslaved the natives to work in the gold and silver mines until death. When some tried to escape, the Spaniards cut off one foot so that the natives could be captured more easily. The Indians then stopped planting food, even for themselves, in an effort to starve out the Spanish conquistadors. They became so unhappy that they discontinued having children. The Indians did not want their children to suffer the same fate they were suffering. To make up for the labor shortage, the Spaniards imported black slaves from Africa. In his book, The Spanish Conquest of America, Sir Arthur Helps estimated that originally the Spanish controlled 32 million souls, and in less than 40 years, the Spanish had destroyed 15 million of them, mainly by working them to death in the silver and gold mines. But the conquistadors encountered one race of natives who were able to withstand them. They were called the Araucanians, and appear to have been culturally connected to the Egyptians, for they venerated a genius for war. It took the Spaniards almost 20 years to subdue them. But a few years later, these same natives reasserted their independence, and in 1553 they captured the Spanish leader and eloquently put him to death by pouring molten gold down his throat. The Spaniards searched for gold as far north as North Carolina. Spanish horseshoes and spearheads have been found in the area of Salisbury, North Carolina. Had they found any easy-to-work gold or silver mines, we Americans would probably all be speaking Spanish now, instead of only half of us. Columbus's voyage to the west led to the plunder of vast amounts of gold and silver from the Americas. The total loot taken from Americas is estimated at 1,232 tons of gold and 60,440 tons of silver. That was just between 1493 and 1690, but only a part of it ever reached Spain. While Spain did the dirty work on the ground, England and Holland adopted a simpler strategy. Once the precious metals were on board ships sailing for the Spanish coast, privateers such as Morgan and Drake and others from various countries hijacked the Spanish ships, and with the plundered gold and silver the Spanish had taken from the Indians, they took the cargo to various countries, mostly England and Holland. Much of this plundered metal was coined into money, and judging from the rise in prices in Holland and England, it was evidently a large amount of booty. Is this what is referred to today as honest money? The Dutch West India Company was established in 1623, specifically to rob the Spanish, and it was a very profitable venture, especially in the first 13 years of the company. They equipped 800 ships and captured 540 ships with $72 million worth of cargo and stole another $36 million from Portuguese colonies. The company was chartered in Amsterdam, which also had the contract for supplying Negro slaves to the Spanish colonies of America. For 50 years they did this, between 1650 and 1700. This slave trade was one of the most important Jewish activities at that time. Between 7 and 18 million slaves were brought to South America, and 400 to 500,000 brought to North America from Africa. England gave charters to pirates, calling them privateers. As this flow of plundered money made its way into Northern Europe, commerce was stimulated, industry began to develop and thrive, the population began growing dramatically, and wealth began to be distributed over a much larger portion of the population as wages rose faster than other prices. Sawmills, spinning wheels, and steam engines were invented. The money supply in 1599 was $87 million. By 1699, it was estimated to be $287 million. A man by the name of Jacob studied prices from 1492 to 1589 and discovered that in France, prices rose 470%. Actual stated prices rose over 700%. But the coinage had also been getting lighter. In England, he found a 400% increase in corn and 500% increase in general prices. He also emphasized that at no time was the price increase a great shock or acceleration. It was spread out over the entire period. From 1500 to 1600, gold and silver lost over 80% of their value, never to recover it. The present day gold is money faction does not appear to be aware of this fact. The plundered money entered Spain and enriched the nobles, not the people. Even with this new wealth, Spain produced little and manufactured less. Spain remained poor because she became rich. This may sound contradictory, but consider that the spoils were concentrated in the hands of the aristocracy. While the democratization and wider distribution of wealth in the North led to increased industry and prosperity, while the increased concentration of wealth in Spain led to stagnation and relative decline. Del Mar said in 1902 that about one half of the existing stock of precious metals was obtained through conquest and slavery. After the gold rush in California in 1849, 80% of the Indian population disappeared. It has been estimated that one half of all the gold and silver that came from America to Europe from 1492 to 1724 was absorbed by China, the Indian trade, and the Levant. We've talked before about the power that was emanated from whoever controlled the gold-silver ratio trade from the East and West. Whoever controlled the gold-silver ratio had the greatest clout in the West. This has been true since the age of Alexander the Great. Opening the Cape route to the East gave Portugal control of the gold-silver ratio trade and the spice trade, making her a great power in Europe for several years. With the opening of the Cape Route, for most of the 16th century, Antwerp, Belgium exploded on the scene and developed into a trading center such as the world had never seen before or since. In 1522, the pawnbrokers of Antwerp asked for the city of England to be put up as collateral for a loan, but the English declined. This is not as crazy as it sounds. In 1976, New York City was put up as collateral for a loan to bail out the municipality. Antwerp's dominance was short-lived. Antwerp is 80 miles from the North Sea and is connected to it by the winding Scheldt River. The Prince of Parma secured the mouth of that river and strangled Antwerp. The Dutch then took over as leaders in the marketplace. The Dutch had 4 ships when she made her first trip around the Cape of Good Hope. 6 companies were formed to engage in trade, and they soon consolidated into the Dutch East India Company and were given the monopoly of the Eastern trade. Between 1565 and 1625, Portuguese traders stripped Japan of 2/3 of its gold, approximately 250 tons. Japan valued the gold-silver ratio at 6-1 and was unaware that the ratio in Europe was as high as 15-1 at that time. The Portuguese had controlled the East-West trade until the Dutch entered the picture, and the Portuguese were not about to lose that profitable trade easily. So the two countries warred with each other. The Dutch outnumbered the Portuguese in both ships and sailors. Amsterdam had thousands of ships. Portugal had 100. Amsterdam had 250,000 sailors. Portugal had 4,000. Although it took from 1605 to 1665, the Dutch finally replaced the Portuguese control over the gold-silver trade. After the Dutch defeated the Portuguese, Amsterdam became the most powerful city in Northern Europe conducting East-West trade. With the closure of Antwerp, Amsterdam sprang to the fore. Amsterdam played a great economic role in world history. After wresting control of the India trade from Portugal, she became Europe's most powerful financial markets and developed the foundation for modern capitalism. It was the powers of the sea that helped in no small way to give her speedy commercial rise. Some Jews emigrating from Antwerp set up an exchange banking operation called the Whistle Bank. They were money changers and discontinuing bills of exchange, taking deposits and making loans. Exchanges were disorderly and merchants needed banking institutions. This was when the city fathers created the Bank of Amsterdam in 1609 and forbade Jews and others from engaging in banking. It was not a bank of issue and was not supposed to make loans, and it was considered a precious metal banking system. All profits of the bank belonged to the city of Amsterdam. The merchants were directed to make their profits in commerce and industry only, not by money-changing games or picking and calling or clipping coinage. The unsavory side of the bank was that the Netherlands attracted silver coinage of neighbors like France by frequent changes in her gold-silver ratio. Officials of the French Mint complained that Amsterdam sent away Her Majesty's coin and bullion by reason of Hollander trading with the East, and by which means the realm will be severely robbed if it is not prevented. When there was a factional fighting in Morocco, Amsterdam's Jewish merchants supplied both sides of the battle. Later, both factions in England's Civil War borrowed in Amsterdam. The aspect of giving financial aid to both sides continues to the present day. This gives the financiers a motive to foment war. In 1642, Queen Henrietta Maria of England personally brought the crown jewels to be pawned in Holland in order to buy arms to be used in the English wars against Holland. Jews also played a large role in publishing books, especially Bibles. The first English language newspaper was printed in Amsterdam in 1620, called The Courant. although the Jews dominated the publishing business in Amsterdam, just like they control all media here in the United States, it was the stock exchange in Amsterdam that attracted them, since banking was off limits to that group of people. They ultimately controlled no less than 25% of the Dutch East India Company. Amsterdam's stock exchange was built in 1611. It handled commodities as well as stocks. From the 1600s onward, Amsterdam's stock exchange was the model of our present stock exchange mechanisms and procedures, and Amsterdam got them from Antwerp, which probably got them from the Levant. The biggest Dutch financiers were Christian houses of Hope and Pelsey. They specialized in bill brokering. The Jews made political loans, like the Dutch House of Orange's William III, to enable him to become King of England. In 1750, about one-third of England's debt was held by Holland, and England paid $1.4 million in annual interest. The Bank of England was floated with Dutch capital, and many Dutch merchants, traders, and financiers migrated to England. When William III of Orange seized the English crown in 1688, capitalism was transferred from Holland to England. England had been a Catholic country until Henry VIII broke with the Roman Church. The person who persuaded Henry VIII to break with the Roman Church was Thomas Cromwell. Thomas Cromwell was a moneylender and was the grandfather of Oliver Cromwell. The king also legalized usury in 1545. When the Western Roman Empire collapsed, so did the English monetary system. From 430 to 630 AD, there was no circulating coinage or medium. It was back to barter for 200 years. When silver coinage reappeared in Europe, England also revived coinage. By 800 to 900 AD, many mints were established in England, but all dies for stamping coins had to come from London. Early Anglo-Saxon mints seem to have been run mainly under ecclesiastical dominion. The Anglo-Saxon pennies were of token value rather than intrinsic value, and were estimated to be one-third over their metal content. They were valued from the word of the king, not from intrinsic value. These Anglo-Saxon kings recoined the money about every 6 years. They called in all coins and issued 3 pennies for every 4 taken in. This was a 25% tax, or about 4% per year. This revenue provided the strength of the late Anglo-Saxon and early Norman kings who adopted the Anglo-Saxon system. The first English gold coinage was by Henry III in 1257. It didn't gain widespread acceptance and was replaced in 1343 by another coin weighing about 93 grains heavier than the original, but silver remained the mainstay of England's coinage. Another problem arises when using precious metal coins as money: clipping. In 1205, King John demonetized all clipped coins over 1/8 clipped. The coinage clippers were mostly Jews. They would start out slowly, clipping only about 5 to 10% of the coins that passed through their hands. Then the next time the clipped coins came through them, they were clipped another 10%. Time and again this happened until England's coinage ended up 50% clipped. Let's take a quick break. After the break, we'll talk about the English money called tally sticks. But now, let me tell you of a couple of places to look for more information. The Lost Science of Money is by far my favorite, and you can get it through the American Monetary Institute. It is a book you can refer to for the rest of your life. It may be the most expensive, but it has the best value for your dollar, I think. Real Money versus False Money - Bank Credit by T. Cushing Daniel is a book that was published in 2004. It was originally published in 1924. It too is good, but you probably will have to get it through Amazon. I did. I've already told you about the writer Alexander Del Mar. He wrote a book called The History of Money in America. I bought this book from Amazon, but you can pull it up on your computer through openlibrary.org. You should do it. It's great. Now let's talk about the item used as money in England called tally stick. The name tally comes from the Latin talia. That means a stake. They were flattened, polished, and seasoned pieces of wood, usually hazel, but also various other types were used. Notches were cut into the wood. The number and depth of the notches showed the value of the transaction. The flat part of the wood was used to write the nature of the transaction, and this written transaction was written on both sides of the stick. Then the stick was split down the middle, with the payer keeping one part, usually a little longer, and the payee getting the smaller part. Length of these tallies varied from a few inches up to about 10 feet, but usually no more than 3 feet. Tallies came into existence in 1100 under King Henry I. He was the fourth son of William the Conqueror. They were used to purchase supplies for the court, to pay the military, and those who worked for the government. Also, they were used to finance public work projects for the king. The king spent the tallies into circulation, therefore saving the ordinary citizen from the clutches of the banking manipulators, with the bankers charging of usury for the use of the money. Tallies were not useless, polished pieces of wood. They were money of the realm and became valuable because the king, using his sovereign power, decreed them, and only them, to be used to pay taxes. This was the factor that infused the value of the tallies and endowed them with monetary utility. Tallies were not only manufactured by the exchequer, but also private tallies were used in business. One of the first shareholders of the Bank of England bought his shares with tally sticks. Tally sticks coming from the king's treasury had different notches in them to distinguish the king's tally from private tallies. Tallies were used as tax receipts also. The crown used them to make sure that county sheriffs had indeed remitted all the taxes they had collected. Because the crown accepted these wooden tallies in payment of taxes, these tallies were thus given the value of coinage when taxes were due. This meant that they functioned as a form of money. Taxes had to be paid with the king's tallies. The two pieces of wood had to match. This made counterfeiting difficult, and counterfeiters were put to death, which was also a deterrent to the practice. Tally sticks were used exclusively as money for 594 years. They were used partially as money for the next 89 years, and they were used unofficially as money for the next 43 years, for a total of 726 years. The English Exchequer used the tally system until 1826, when the tallies were no longer used by the Exchequer as money. They were used as firewood and burned to heat government offices. In 1834, the House of Parliament was completely destroyed when the sticks were burned in the furnace and the flue overheated. See? Tallies were useful right up to the end. Well, that's our show for today. I hope you'll join us next time when we'll talk a little bit more about money, and we'll talk about a very important legal case called Mixed Money. You need to listen to this one. It's good.